course, that Irish American Magazine is the leading national glossy publication of Irish interest in North America. Believe it or not, it was, my God, what happened to the decades here? Its inception, 1985, and Irish American Magazine has become the most powerful vehicle for expression on a range of political, economic, social, and cultural themes, and of course, all of paramount importance to the Irish in America and the Irish wannabes. It helped reestablish, of course, Irish ethnic identity in the United States. And in fact, friends, I think while a lot of, at least rumor has it, that a great number of print media organizations are struggling. Not so Irish American Magazine. Trish Harty, who is the editor-in-chief and co-founder of Irish American Magazine, has through the years conducted such an amazing array of Irish Americans, or those who have some affinity to their Irishness, and she has also interviewed and produced a podcast of one of many of her interviews with some of the greatest stars of not only of theater and film, political figures, including, of course, the President Clinton. And, well, enough than that. She is from Nina and County Tipperary. And we were looking for actually a singer to sing, you know, a Tipperary song, but then we used up Frank Patterson already, so we had to slither the whole way up to Donegal to get Daniel O'Donner. Good. Any Tipperary song? Okay, now, Daniel, do this one justice, okay?
I can pay my way entirely. I'll enjoy your company. Leave me off at any Tipperary town. Sure, there's Castleton and Flora, old Boris or Clonin. You can't leave me where I've never been before. In Ross Grey, Dundrum or Tarry, in Furness or Clonmel, or my birthplace by the town of Templemore. Leave me on the road to Nina, hear the rippling Shannon call, where the Yarra Mountains join silver mine. I'd be happy to impair where the Galty shadows fall. I'm at home in any Tipperary town.
You know, I suppose I could have maybe should have played a song from Judy Collins, but you know, we know what we're doing here. You think a song, a tune from Judy Collins would carry more weight with Trish Harty than and Lead Me Off in Any Tipperary? No, could not. And that's it. So that wasn't an error at all in our part. We make a lot of errors around. Actually, we don't make any, do we? No. what's the dirty look for there on your shirt? Okay, tell you what we do. What we will do, friends, is let's just go to Irish American Magazine to Trish Harty, editor-in-chief, and let her, and we listen to her as she interviews the great Judy Collins.
Hello, my name is Dave Lewis, and while I'm the regular host of The Story, Irish American Magazine's bi-weekly podcast, where we explore the stories of what's happening and what's happened in the Irish community, today's episode will be hosted by co-founder and editor-in-chief of Irish American Magazine, Patricia Harty, as she talks with the legendary singer, Judy Collins. Please enjoy. Good morning, Judy.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for doing The Story with Irish American Magazine.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You know I love your magazine. It's the best. Thank you.
So I saw you recently in Santa Rosa at a sold-out concert. Do you want to talk about your concerts with this amazing tour you've been doing with Stephen Sills?
Oh, well, it's wonderful. We've known each other for 51 years now, and we started recording in 1968. He was Stills was on a record of mine called Who Knows Where the Time Goes. And we had an affair which lasted long enough for him to write a song about me called Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, and actually a number of other songs about me. He's finally admitting that Helplessly Hoping was about me. And so we have remained friends, and we started talking about 2 years ago about doing concerts together. Now we've already done 75 shows.
And you're doing more.
Yes, we are. We've got 25 more coming up starting in September of 2018. And then we're probably going to do 50 more in 2019.
Well, I have to say that I tremendously, really enjoyed your show in Santa Rosa, California. I know it was your original show was canceled because of the fire out there. But
being
a more joyous, more welcoming audience. I mean, the place was absolutely packed. And I love how you both interact on the stage together, and then you kind of do your own thing, and Stephen does his thing, and then it's like three concerts in one.
It really is. It's very exciting because we have a wonderful band, and we have an awfully good time. So it's a good change for me to be out with him because normally I go out on my own, so it's very refreshing. And we get to sing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes together. Didn't you love that?
I just thought it was great. So I also wanted to talk about, because it brought up memories of your activism, and while it's a wonderful concert for people who love your music, nobody there is forgetting that you were also an activist, and I know that you went south and you fought for voters' rights for black people, and you did other things. And there was the story out of Chicago, if you want to talk a little bit about that, because I love it, where you in front of the judge and what you did. But what I wanted to talk about mostly today was the reaction to from the audience. And I have to say, it's not like you were singing in front of a group of Mexican migrants. This was a lot of older white people, some Vietnam vets, and some younger people, like my nieces in her 30s. And the whole audience erupted when you sang Dreamers. You did it a cappella. You just stood in front of the audience, and you just let fly with this beautiful song called Dreamers and could you talk a little bit about that song?
Oh, yes, thank you. Dreamers was written a couple of years ago when it was sort of sitting around in my computer, and then I set the music to it, and my husband, Lewis, told me that I should do something new in Seattle in February of 2018, and I sang it, and I was so amazed at the response. I sang it a cappella, and the audience reacted the way in which the audience did in Santa Rosa. Just total silence, and then this incredible burst of applause and tears, really. And, you know, what it made me realize is that people really need to have their own emotional convictions supported in music. And maybe that's what music does for us, whatever the subject is that touches us. And when it's about such a particularly painful situation as immigration and the Dreamers, I think it brought out everybody's very best intentions, don't you?
I think so. It was heartfelt for me as an immigrant who has to stand by and watch other immigrants go through this horrible nativist element that's happening now in the country. It harkens back to the early days of the Irish when they came No Irish Need Apply sign.
Yeah.
You know, George Mitchell, the great peace negotiator, once told me about the early Irish settlements in Maine. And he said something to me that I'll never forget because I think of it every time it's raining and I can't get a cab. He said, they walked to Maine. They came in to Grosse
Pointe. Oh, my God.
They walked across the border to Maine.
Oh.
And they met these nativist groups along the way. So that's when I hear about the wall, that's what I think about and when I hear about the deportation. So thank you for that. Can you give me the first couple lines of that song?
Yes, my name is Maria. My daughter is a dreamer. She says that she's worried that she will have to leave. And the chorus goes, this world, this land was made by dreamers and children of those dreamers. We came here for democracy and hope. Now all we have is hope. And we're all immigrants, every one of us. Maybe the American Indians think of themselves as the first native tribes, but they also probably came over the Bering Strait from Russia someplace. So we're all immigrants, every one of us. Yeah.
So do you feel, I feel in a way, that that you have this activist spirit that's starting a little revolution out there. This song is now on the Billboard charts.
Yes, it is. And it was released by, I believe, Rolling Stone, and then went to Billboard, and then was released through NPR. There's a beautiful recording of it and a discussion about immigration itself. And also, it will be after the 1st of September, after everybody comes back from the holiday, it will be worked on in what they call the different media platforms. Isn't that funny? Maybe it'll even make television. We're hoping for one of the big shows.
I think it would be great. I think it's like it's slowly, really, it's gathering speed, you know.
It's slowly gathering speed, absolutely.
It's such a beautiful way, to use your talent. I think that I always think that it's the creative people that will come through in the end, the poets and the writers and the musicians and, the people that connect up our humanity. But this is not your first shot at activism. I know there's a story about
the Chicago 7, yes.
Chicago 7, and I guess the 60s is really in the news again. I've been watching clips of the convention and all of this sort of stuff. Do you want to just briefly touch on that incident?
Yes. I did not go to the convention. It was just too disturbing, the whole idea of getting out there with the Chicago police turning out to beat people up. But I had been at the conference that announced the presence of the Yippies. And, of course, Abby Hoffman and Dave Dillinger were there. And I was friends with that bunch. Phil Oakes came to my house, my apartment, the morning of St. Patrick's Day in 1968. And he said, how are you? It was very early. And he was a good friend, so he knew he could knock the door and get in. And I was busy making green cupcakes for my son to take to school with him. And Phil said, you have to come down to the Ambassador Hotel with me. We're having the announcement of the Yippies, and you have to come down with me and sing a song. So I said, okay, I got dressed and got down, and I sang for the press conference that announced the forming of the Yippies. Well, then, of course, they were beaten up and handcuffed and sent to jail during the Chicago convention in 1968. And their lawyer, Barry Kunstler, called me, and he said, the following year when the trial started, and he said, would you come to Chicago and testify? And I said, of course, they're my friends. They're no more criminals than I am. I mean, they want peace. That's what they want. That's all they want. So I went to Chicago, and I testified, and the judge, Hoffman, said to me, now, what did you do at the conference? And I opened my mouth, and I began to sing, where have all the flowers gone? And the court clerk came over and put his hand over my mouth and shut me up. So that was my experience.
You've had an incredible career, and you're still having an incredible career. And what's your motivation for keeping on?
Well, I have the training. I was blessed with some talent, and I also got a good upbringing in a lot of things. First of all, I was the oldest of five. So that makes it, you know, you get to be very responsible and learn how to show up and clean up the garbage and throw out the mess and make the beds and clean the bathrooms and carry around your siblings who are little. And so that's all it is, being a performer. That's what you do, basically. Only you sing on top of it all. So I think I got very well trained. And the other thing is, I love what I do. Being able to be a songwriter and a writer, because I've written a lot of books, as you know, and also been writing songs since 1967, when Leonard Cohen said to me, why aren't you writing your own songs? So my most recent song, which I started yesterday, is called The Ballad of Belle Star. So I've been writing ever since. And, of course, Maria, I wrote, you know, as I said, a couple of years ago. But I'm writing all the time. And
you've also written songs to your parents. And I know that you've written many books. But you're working on a book about your father?
I am. And I've written, as you said, songs about my father. That was one of the first songs I ever wrote. My father always promised us. And my mother, The Twilight, I wrote about 8 years ago after she died. And, you know, I'm sorry I didn't write it while she died, but it wasn't possible. The picture of who she was is in retrospect, is such, for me, such a portrait that is very, very important to me.
Could you just talk a little bit about your mother? You have that wonderful memoir where you really bring your parents alive. And I feel like I know this family from your writing, which audience, if you haven't read Judy's book, you're in for a treat. But can you just talk a little bit about your father and the fact that he was a performer?
He was an interesting man, which is why I keep getting engaged in writing a book about him. He was blind from the age of four. And he got to do everything. He learned Braille, of course, in school. He was a top-notch student and got a scholarship to the University of Idaho in Moscow, Idaho, and became a radio personality. He married my mother in 1937 and started his radio career in Seattle and was a touring artist and a radio performer and a great pianist and singer. And he said, you know, he raised a family of five of us, and he was a big star in the towns he worked in, and he was amazing. He performed and showed up and did his work, and everybody loved him. And he was an activist himself. He talked about politics on the radio all the time.
Didn't he used to bake for you guys, or?
Oh, Mom did the baking, but he was the one who discovered Gaylord Houser in the 40s in Hollywood. All the big stars in Hollywood would use Gaylord Houser, including people like Ingrid Bergman and Gloria Swanson. They all were devotees of Gaylord Houser, who invented the idea of using health foods and making a combination of yogurt and wheat germ and blackstrap molasses and raw eggs to cure your hangover. We also had things like a cucumber mask for women. And I don't do this often enough, but he had women lie down on the floor and put their legs up on the bed to increase blood flow and do things like holding your stomach in a few moments every day.
Wow.
It was an exercise that was free and that helped your figure. So all these women were and he was also very handsome and very provocative, I think, and he had all these women just howling at his heels. And my father learned all about Gaylord Houser. So we didn't have any white bread or white rice in the house, and we ate healthy. You know, we ate wonderful, fresh produce. Of course, you could get it in California and even in Colorado when we moved there. So he was always fighting his own alcoholism with all this health treatment, and probably it helped me with mine as well.
Can you talk a bit about that? Because your book, Cravings, is fascinating. You mentioned Gaylord Houser and many other early diet gurus, and you talk about your own cravings in terms of, you said something really interesting when I talked to you about this book, was that your body, because it's a certain temperature, can turn certain foods into alcohol, and if you have allergies to alcohol, those same food allergies can affect you.
Oh, yes. Two things that occur to me that have come up recently. One is I've now seen a statistic that 1 out of 10 Americans die from alcohol use and or abuse. Now, that would, of course, apply to people who are either obese, overweight, anorexic, bulimic, or want to lose 20 pounds before Christmas so they can get into their dress. The allergy is to the same foods that are in alcohol. The allergy is sugar, grains, wheat, flour, and corn. 5 foods, that's it. Of course, we don't eat potatoes anyway. Most people know that who try to lose weight. And dairy is not a great friend to weight loss. However, with these foods, they do turn into alcohol in your body, and they do make those who are sensitive of us respond by wanting more, 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 more. So I wrote this book since I've been in recovery from my eating disorder for decades now, and been in and out of food treatment programs until I found the right one. It's a simple formula. And if we have 3 meals a day and we don't eat any of those foods, we can count on a better health.
Well, I think everybody who was interested in this should actually read your book, because there's so much great information in there. And a friend of mine said, who struggled for years with her weight, said it was the first book that made sense to her. And actually, I hear your voice in my head now every day about 3 o'clock when I have that sugar urge, and you said, you're dehydrated, just drink some water. Drink some water.
Yes, yes. Water, tea, black coffee, black tea, in between. And Perrier, of course, if you want all kinds of sparkling waters. And they have these nice flavored sparkling waters now, too, that have no sugar in them. There's a lot of alternatives now, in spite of the fact that junk is everywhere on hand. But one can ignore it. And by the way, within 20 days, within 2 weeks, your body is free and clear. And, you know, with every diet that you take, and I did all these little biographies of diet gurus just to show people the story, which is that when you're on these things, these little diets for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, then when you get to the point, you know, you've lost the weight, you're getting clear, you've lost 10 pounds at least, then they say to you, okay, well, you can go back to being normal. Well, I don't know what normal is. I never heard of normal. I mean, I couldn't be normal. I mean, I've got some strange idea about normal. So for me, it's better just to stay away from sugar, grains, flour, corn, and wheat.
The thing about cravings is that you're right. After a couple of weeks, once you get it out of your system,
Yeah.
You can just stay away from it.
Yeah.
In Ireland, you know, it was funny. Us women always gave up sugar for Lent. Like,
all my
sisters and my mother.
Yeah.
I watched my brothers putting, like, 6 spoons of sugar into their tea, and I was like, didn't you guys give up sugar for Lent, ever? What did you give up?
Yeah, what did they give up? I wonder.
There's a couple more questions, and I know you're running because you have more shows coming up. You have traveled, you've done how many shows in the last couple of years? You never seem to stop.
Well, I do about 120 shows a year, average, and then 50 of those have been with stills last year, and that'll be true this year, too. So I am not stopping in any way.
We've been lucky enough to have had you at our events over the years. Thank you so much, and to induct you into our Irish America Hall of Fame.
It was such a pleasure
to be in Ireland to celebrate the anniversary of, or commemorate the anniversary of JFK's trip there, the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, that was wonderful, with the Irish Air Force flying overhead.
I know, you've done numerous concerts in Ireland. Do you have any plans for an upcoming one?
Oh, yes, I'm going to be coming back in 2019, so I look forward to it.
Great. And I want to mention our Hall of Fame again. One year we had Eileen Collins, which was pretty amazing. She was the first woman astronaut to captain the space shuttle and to pilot the space shuttle. And you had written a song for her. It was just completely coincidental that you were there and you had written a song for her.
It was amazing. I was commissioned by NASA to write the song for her. And because she was the first woman to captain the space shuttle. And so I sang the song. It's called Beyond the Sky. And I was able to sing it for her there at the commemoration with her at Irish American Magazine. And it was very exciting. And most recently, I was in Telluride a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it was only a few days ago. And I got a note from a NASA astronaut named Brewster Shaw. And Brewster Shaw says that he was a 1980s NASA astronaut and flew three missions on the space shuttle. And he used to play my music while he was flying in space. Isn't that exciting?
That is so exciting. Oh, what's your favorite album?
So sweet. True Stories and Other Dreams, which came out. It has a lot of my own writing on. Has the song about my sister, the Weaver song about my sister Holly. It has that on this. Anyway, a lot of my songs, my own songs, so that was exciting.
I wanted to get back to a serious note because you talked about being in Ireland, and I know that on the radio over there you've talked about suicide. And I know that recently it's come up for you again.
Yes, it has. I actually was contacted by a relative of a very famous person that committed suicide, and we've been talking. Of course, she called me up because she wanted to talk to somebody else who'd lost a son. And in our discussions, she said, you know, and I had a lot of people help me after Clark's death. My son died in 1992. And Joan Rivers and Marriott Hartley and Gloria Vanderbilt, all of whom lost people, friends or children, to suicide. And they all helped me. And Iris Bolton, who wrote a great book about suicide called My Son, My Son. And I wanted my friend to have a support system. And so we've been talking, and she said, you know, I'm going to go get my son's name tattooed on my wrist. And she said, you want to come? And I said, yes, you know, this is now 26 years after my son's death. But meantime, I went down to the tattoo artist on Lafayette, and I got Clark's name tattooed on my wrist. And in addition, I had a swallow, too. Tattooed on my wrist, just to add to the visual impact of swallows flying, you know.
Always returning.
And always returning to Capistrano and other places.
Yes, but you did say that people find it strange to talk about suicide.
Yes. In
Ireland, we have a very high suicide rate, particularly of young men, but also women. It's something I think that we need to talk more about.
Oh, yes. And the thing about it, taboo, it's sort of like this whole situation with the abuse of young people by priests. Now that it's out in the open, we can talk about it. As long as we could talk, we could never talk about suicide because it was so foreboding. You know, the church banned it and governments decried it. And in the old days, they could hang you if you tried to kill yourself. You know, it's horrible what they've done to suicide survivors. And so I must say, I think of all the prevention that's talked about, I think, and there are I do a lot of speaking about this around mental health, alcoholism, suicide, depression. You know, alcohol is a depressant, so in many cases it does lead to suicide. Alcohol and drug addiction, terrible promoters of suicidal ideology, they call it. And I must say that I think of all the things that people recommend, talk is the most productive, the most positive, because now that people are talking, or they talk about the person, they talk about themselves, they talk about their pain, their what they've had to go through to subsume their own suicide ideas. So talking is, I think, the most cure for mental illness of all kinds. And that's true for therapy in terms of getting into therapy. Nowadays, of course, we have the insurance company saying, no, we don't want to pay for anything. I mean, if you get 20 talk therapy sessions out of your insurance, you're doing pretty well, when you actually need a lifetime.
Judy, you've got so many different, you wear so many different hats. I know that you're a mentor to a lot of people, especially young musicians. You speak out, your whole activism, your continued presence on PBS, which is awesome. And I was just wondering, how do you keep it all together? Do you do yoga? Do you meditate? How do you do all this travel? I'm checking your calendar, and like for all of September and October and November, it seems you're going to be on the road.
Yeah, I'll be on the road most of the time. I got a whole, well, I got about 3 weeks, I think, of vacation just in the end of the summer, the end of July, and 3 weeks in August. So I've had my share, and then I spent the day in bed yesterday. So that's how I do it. You know, I'm out on the road all the time, but I do rest when I can, and I do exercise, and I do a small amount of yoga, a lot of exercise, a lot of 3 meals a day, nothing in between, and no sugar, grain, flour, corn, and wheat, prayer, activism, keeping track of my nephews and nieces and my friends. I have a batch of young friends that I stay in touch with, a bunch of women that I connect with on a pretty regular basis. So, and I have a very good marriage, you know. So I'm surrounded by good people like you, and that's how it happens. That's how I do it.
We just have to keep on keeping on.
Yeah, we just keep on keeping on. Exactly.
Judy, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you this morning. I wish you all the best of luck in your upcoming travels, and I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you so much. Much love, and thank you for this wonderful magazine that you put out every 2 months and a weekly newsletter.
Everybody out there should sign up for it. It's great. For any of you out there who would like to subscribe to Irish American Magazine, it's 1-800-582-6642.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to more episodes, please subscribe to us on iTunes, where you can rate and review the podcast so more people can see us. We are also available on Anchor for all of our Android users out there. Just search Irish American Magazine and you'll find us there. Don't forget to follow us on our social media pages and to subscribe to Irish American Magazine. Slán.
Great interview there by Trish Hardy, who had so many interesting aspects there, and really drew out Judy Collins. Judy, three years ago, a little bit more, Judy was in Ireland for a live concert at Drumoulin Castle. It was organized by Donegal-born New York PR guru Tarla McConnell, and it was sponsored by Quinnipiac University, home of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum. It was a tremendous experience, and again, the venue obviously was great as well. One of the songs that Judy Collins sang was this one, the Gypsy Rover, which was actually written, was composed by Leo Maguire back in the 1950s. A great song. And again, though, we would like to, welcome Trish Hardy, Irish American Magazine. If we go back to, again, that was the inception of Irish American Magazine. Now, I can't believe it's 33 years ago. Publisher Neil O'Dowd and editor-in-chief. It is not only a great Irish-American magazine, it is recognized as the only national glossy publication of interest in all of North America. Okay, we are going to go back to Drumoulin Castle and to the live concert of Judy Collins as we sign off here with the Gypsy Rover.
The Gypsy Rover came over the hill, down through the valley so shady. He whistled and he sang till the greenwood rang, and he won the heart of a lady. You know it. Adi to Adi to Adi. Adi to Adi to Adi. He whistled and he sang till the greenwood rang, and he won the heart of a lady. She left her father's castle gate. She left her fair young lover. She left her servants and her state to follow the Gypsy Rover. Adi-do-adi-do-adi. Adi-do-adi-do-adi. He whistled and he sang to the greenwood rang, and he won the heart of a lady. Her father settled up his fastest steed. He roamed the valley all over. He sought his daughter at great speed, and the whistling gypsy rover.
friends, that brings us to the end of the program, one which we hope you have enjoyed our programs. Again, yeah, one more time there, Anya Sheridan and myself, Adrian Flannelly. Want to thank you for listening to the Flannelly Show Live. Anytime, at your convenience, log on to Irish Radio, irishradio.com. So long. God bless. Have a great weekend and a great evening.